In the first hour of the program today, we'll be talking about Indonesia. And certainly, of all of the countries that were affected by last month's tsunami, Indonesia was the hardest hit. And it seems only to have been the most recent in a series of crises that the Indonesians have had to deal with over the last few years, certainly over the last few decades. Among them, an economic crisis, basically the same that affected other countries in Asia some years back. Also, political upheaval. There has been ethnic conflict. Also, several places in Indonesia, there are groups of people who are demanding their independence. This morning, in this hour of the program, we'll try to look back over these last few years of Indonesian history as we talk with Lauren Leiter. He is professor of government at Cornell University. As we talk, of course, questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. So at any point here, questions are certainly welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people try to be brief in making their points so that we can keep the program moving, get in as many different people as possible. But, of course, anyone listening is welcome. Again, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Professor Leiter, hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me, David.
Well, we appreciate
just a brief,
it.
Brief correction.
Oh,
my name is Lauren Leiter.
Lauren Leiter. Well, now,
yes.
My apologies to you because...
Not a problem.
I happen to have your vita right here in front of me, and there it is spelled correctly, but on my schedule, it is not. So my sincere apologies. I sort of hate to begin with a geography lesson, but I think it might be a good idea just for people who don't know very much about Indonesia to talk a little bit about what makes it special. And certainly you'd have to comment on the level of diversity of this country, the amount of geography it covers, how many different people there are, how many different ethnic groups, how many different languages. I'm not certain that there are too many other places on the earth that could match the level of diversity that Indonesia has.
Well, that's right, David. Your observation is absolutely correct. Indonesia is one of the most diverse places on earth. It's an archipelagic nation consisting of 13,000 islands, a few big ones, including Java and Sumatra. Sumatra is the island where Aceh is the northern tip of the island of Sumatra. Indonesia developed a national language during its anti-colonial nationalist movement called Indonesian, which was based on the language spoken mostly in the northern part of Sumatra called Malay, also spoken in Malaysia and other places in Southeast Asia. But each of these islands, and in fact some of the islands, had dozens or hundreds of languages even. Hundreds of different languages are spoken throughout Indonesia. Virtually every major religious faith is practiced in Indonesia. Of course, Islam is the most dominant, but also Christianity, Buddhism, Hinduism, and even in a very small way, Judaism. And even Islam is extraordinarily diverse, ranging from fairly what one might call fundamentalist beliefs to very rural-oriented traditionalist beliefs, to modernist Islam practiced in the cities often, and also kind of Javanese syncretism between Islam and older Javanese practices, which are rooted in Hindu-Buddhist syncretism.
Maybe then now we'll move to talking a little bit about the most recent news, and that is the tsunami that hit right the day after Christmas. As I said, of all of the countries that were hit by the tsunami, Indonesia was the one that was most hard hit. But the most serious damage was in one particular place. That is the place right where the earthquake that precipitated the tsunami happened, the place called Aceh. What sort of larger significance for Indonesia does this disaster have, apart from the immediate problems posed by the damage in Aceh?
Well, All kinds, David. One might begin, first of all, with the simple fact that Aceh has been a conflict region for a very long time, one might say since the 19th century, but particularly badly in the last 30 years, where there's been an ongoing conflict between the Indonesian military and Acehnese separatists. But in a broader context, this also affects the Indonesian military relations with much of the rest of the world, and in particular the United States. And I hope that that sort of both of these factors would be something we'll be focusing on in the rest of the discussion today.
Well, let's talk about what it is that that the people in Aceh want. Now, as I mentioned, there are other places in Indonesia where there are separatist independence movements. Is it that simply what this is in a straightforward way? It's a group of people who are seeking, if not autonomy, then true independence?
Well, it's obviously not quite that simple. Aceh, just to give you sort of the sketchy background, and we can go into some of the details in more thoroughly, I think, but Aceh was an independent sultanate in the 19th century. Was one of the places that most successfully resisted colonialism, Dutch colonialism. Indonesia, what is now Indonesia, was a Dutch colony known as the Netherlands East Indies. And the Sultanate of Aceh had been one of the being furthest away almost from the center of Dutch power in which what is now Jakarta, which was then known as Batavia. Aceh basically resisted Dutch control and fought a long war with the Dutch from 1873 to 1903, more or less. The reason that this is important is because as the Indonesian nation took shape after World War II, the Acehnese had a particularly ambivalent relationship with Jakarta, at first supporting the Republic of Indonesia against the returning Dutch. Over time, being quite dissatisfied for a number of reasons, which ultimately in the 1950s led to an initial rebellion against the center called the Darul Islam Rebellion, which eventually ended in a negotiated settlement in the 1960s, only to kind of be reawakened in a different form by the Aceh Merdeka, Free Aceh movement that started in 1976. And when I say in a different form, it was almost an entirely new context. And this had much less to do, I should say, with factors like Acehnese autonomy and cultural values like the importance of Islamic law and so forth, and much more to do with economic questions, particularly the control of resources. And in the 1970s was the time that liquid natural gas was becoming heavily exploited in Aceh. And eventually some major international oil corporations set up shop there, including Exxon. That, in fact, precipitated much of the discontent in the 1970s. Almost all of the revenues from this liquid natural gas was going to Jakarta, and very little was being returned to Aceh. Let's leave it there for now, and we can go into more detail if necessary.
Well, let me ask you this question. As you say, there has been this this fighting going on between the Indonesian military and the Free Aceh movement more than 20 years now. With the recent tsunami, there was some talk about both sides saying, well, let's put that aside for the moment because the more pressing issue is how is it we're going to try to assist people who were hurt by the natural disaster and achieve some rebuilding. And then it wasn't very long before there were reports that, in fact, the Indonesian military was launching a new offensive against the Free Aceh movement and perhaps using the disaster as a kind of a cover for that effort. What is happening right now? Do we know what's happening right now?
Well, we of course know much of what's happening right now. I wish it were the case that that both parties saw the disaster as a chance to put aside the conflict. Unfortunately, I don't think that has ever been exactly true. I think that as the rest of the world watched the disaster, natural disaster unfold, and realized the incredible extent of human need of relief operations, that people were baffled, I think, by the fact that despite this incredible tragedy in which perhaps 160,000 people died and maybe 500,000 more have been left homeless and in internal displacement camps, more or less, that people were surprised, in fact, that this conflict between the military and the Free Aceh movement was going on. I think from the point of view of these parties in Indonesia, that this was never exactly the case, that both, and particularly the military, immediately saw this as an opportunity, in fact, to resolve the conflict in their favor. I personally was very optimistic and hopeful that perhaps, given the incredible scale of the deaths, that the military might be shamed and humbled, that they might say, oh, enough people have died in Aceh, we can't pursue the hard line that we've been pursuing all of these years, and in particular in the last couple of years, and that they might actually allow some space for Acehnese to organize themselves, initially maybe to assist in relief efforts, but ultimately perhaps to have some greater political voice. But unfortunately, that doesn't seem to have happened in that way. Hmm.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Lauren Ryder. He's professor of government at Cornell. We're talking about Indonesia, and questions are certainly welcome. Here, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. So here at any point, questions certainly are welcome. Back in 1998, the longtime ruler of the country, Suharto, was forced to step down because, and again, I guess this is may be a superficial understanding on my part, but because of really widespread dissatisfaction about the way the government dealt with the Asian economic crisis of the time. Certainly something that would have broadly affected Indonesians. Again, I guess I'm interested in if there's any sort of parallel between the kind of challenge that the government was facing at that time and the kind of challenges posed by the natural disaster that now the relatively new government and the first democratically elected president Indonesia has ever had faces today.
Well, I'm not sure if you could say that it was its parallel in any way. I think because it was the first widely recognized legitimate elections since perhaps 1955. Well, if maybe the second, if you include 1999, people are willing to give a lot of leeway to the new Indonesian government being an elected government. I don't think that there's a widespread discouragement with it at this time. Fortunately, the case in Aceh is entirely different. It never was a situation where there's much trust in the central government. So, I mean, when you talk about Indonesia as a whole and talk about Aceh, you may be talking about different things. And the same is true perhaps also in West Papua, where there's also been longstanding sentiment against the center. But for most of the rest of Indonesia, I think there's considerable willingness to give this government a go.
Well, is there also, though, a lot of what I read suggests also that people are really, their expectations are high, their expectations of this man, the former general, Mr. Yudhoyono, who is now the president, they're expecting a lot, and one wonders just how patient they're going to be. What is it that people are hoping are going to happen? And what are they looking now to this new government to do?
Well, of course, it depends on what people. But for many years, the major concern of most people, particularly in the greater population center of Java and in Jakarta, has been economic recovery. And they're looking looking for that. And unfortunately, what goes along with that for in many people's minds that are in, living in Jakarta is stability, which means sort of a greater willingness to revert to actually some of the tactics that were being used during the Suharto regime, which may mean more rather than less military influence. For a period, the military was very discredited. All of the horrible human rights abuses that were committed by the Indonesian military during the Suharto period, which lasted from 65 to 98, were dredged up. And the military's credibility was very, very low. But there developed a certain kind of nostalgia, particularly among elites in Jakarta, for sort of the good old days of stability and order, which, by the way, was also a Dutch colonial motto. I think that people tend to see a restoration of stability as being a prior condition of economic recovery.
Well, I have a caller here to bring into the conversation. Why don't we do that? And I'm sure we'll get to some other things as well. Again, our guest is Lauren Ryder. He's professor of government at Cornell, and we're talking about Indonesia. And questions are welcome, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana listeners. We do also have a toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call, use that one, and we'll pay for the call. That is 800-222-9455. Caller here is in Champaign County. That's to start us off. Line number one. Hello.
Hi. It's an incredibly complex issue, and most people don't know much about it here in the U.S., but the U.S. role is what I'd like to focus on, from mobile to cronyism. I mean, some people in this area have been radicalized because one of the cronies of the Indonesian regime, Rowanto, actually had an investment in the area and had a nasty strike that brought attention to the Indonesian ownership, and it was sort of a economic blowback phenomenon, but there's a lot of unpacking there. But what I would like to start with is the natural gas off of Aceh and the Mobil fields, Exxon Mobil fields. Exxon Mobil, you know, rose to the occasion of the tsunami to give $2 million to the fund, when they have $40 billion apparently estimated in natural gas holdings, which they pay very little to. As many people die from public health problems in the region monthly as died in the tsunami. Well, maybe that's not quite true anymore, but maybe it's every 2 months because the figure has gotten so hideously large. So between that kind of corporate and economic role, we have, you know, Wolfowitz, former ambassador, going over there to fix it and try to, you know, facilitate military collaboration again. A lot of, you know, this people are talking about how we've avoided military connection for these many years as a response to the killing in Timor, but they were finding ways around this all along. They used a nominally U.S. military training program. In other words, they said the purpose of the operation was to train U.S. military, but actually what they were doing is they were training the Indonesian military at the time. So there's been a way around this all along, and it's the U.S. role is just surreally large and uncommented on. So I'm having a little trouble holding it together here, so I think I'd say over to you. Thanks.
All right. Well, Professor Ryder, you want to comment on any or all of that?
Well, there's a lot there to comment on, but let's just sort of break it down for the audience. This caller obviously has a good deal of familiarity with the situation, but we should point out that the U.S. support for the Indonesian military was very high since Suharto took power in 1966, and basically turned a blind eye to, first of all, huge massacre of hundreds of thousands of leftists in the 1960s, and then to the invasion of East Timor in 1975, which used U.S. military equipment, and to many other gross human rights abuses during the regime, including notably a big crackdown in Aceh that began in the late 1980s And in fact, Indonesia was very emboldened by the fact that there was no international attention coming to Indonesia because of such abuses, and that was one of the reasons for the intensity of the operations against the separatist Free Aceh movement in the late 1980s and 1990s. For various reasons, the massacre in East Timor in 1991 brought attention to these abuses by the military, and there was a very effective international mobilizing campaign in support of East Timor during the 1990s, which wound up curbing U.S. military assistance to Indonesia, and much to this dissatisfaction of the Pentagon, who has since that time has been essentially battling Congress, the U.S. Congress, for the restoration of full military assistance to Indonesia. After Suharto fell, there was a sentiment among U.S. policymakers to use the opportunity to encourage reform of the Indonesian military and more democratization and so forth. Unfortunately, since September 11th, that approach has been minimized and steadily declining. And there has been an even stronger view coming from the Pentagon and certain foreign policy officials that aid and assistance and foreign military sales to the Indonesian military should be fully restored, which has been sort of periodically obstructed by Congress, which has tried to put conditions on the restoration of such aid. The last in the series of claims has to do with the murders of two Americans in West Papua by the Indonesian military, which the Indonesian military has distanced itself from. And I believe the FBI sort of cleared the Indonesian military of. And so there's a lot of intergovernmental bickering in the United States about what to do about assistance. But because of September 11th, there has been kind of a leeway given. And one of the people who is most insistent upon full restoration of aid to the Indonesian military and assistance and sales and so forth is Paul Wolfowitz, the Deputy Secretary of State, who, as the caller mentioned, served once as the Indonesian ambassador to the American ambassador to Indonesia in the period that immediately preceded the crackdown in Aceh. And so that the post 9/11 situation has made conditions worse, particularly in Aceh. The Indonesian military has capitalized on this, calling the separatists terrorists. I guess in a way that's quite parallel to the way that Israel capitalized on the situation by calling the Palestinians terrorists, and so on. So the condition post 9/11 and pre tsunami was already very bad, and in favor of even more hardline approach to Aceh. And in fact, martial law was declared again in Aceh in 2003 by Megawati Sukarno-Putri, who was then the president. And there are concerns this situation will lead to greater cooperation and more direct assistance to the Indonesian military by the United States, that the United States is looking to this as a way to restore this aid. Unfortunately, the Indonesian military has not exactly lived up to the expectations. If the Indonesian military could have been showed itself to the world as being very effective in disaster relief, maybe that would have been more politically palatable. Fortunately, they seem to have not much of an eye towards the consequences of continuing this conflict with the Free Aceh movement and using aid relief in quite corrupt ways, one might say. So that's a lot. There's also the issue of mobile oil that was raised by the caller, but maybe you can come back to that since I've already laid all of this out.
Well, let's also go and talk to someone else. We have a second caller here, someone in Champaign. This is line number two. Hello.
Yes. I was wondering if you could talk about the notion that some people have of uniting the Philippines, I believe, and Malaysia and Indonesia, or at least certain countries there, into some kind of caliphate. That's one question. And then I'm interested to know more about these different approaches to Islam that you mentioned. You mentioned a syncretic Islam, and then maybe you could tell us how modernist Islam came to the fore, and now there are new forces moving people towards a more fundamentalist Islam. I'm wondering what those forces are. Why are people turning perhaps from a modernist Islam to a fundamentalist Islam, which seems to me imported from outside?
Well, it's interesting that you tie the unity of Malaysia, the Philippines, and Indonesia to the caliphate. That's actually probably an element of certain kinds of discourse among Islamicists in Indonesia. But actually, the notion was advanced by somebody who's hardly regarded as an Islamicist by the first president of Indonesia, Sukarno, uh-huh. who had this concept called Mafalindo. And he was the one that actually wanted to try to create this united Malaysian, Philippine, Indonesian
what
state,
did the other
which
countries?
Never, nothing came of it.
Uh-huh. What did the other countries think of it?
They thought that it was an expansionist ambition, of course.
Right, right, a colonialist or imperialist, okay.
But as far as the question of Islam is concerned, I mean, it's a very complicated and involved history, but modernist Islam took the shape of in the early part of the 20th century as a group that was instrumental in uniting the sort of Islamic trading networks and, in fact, gave rise to sort of the first anti-colonial nationalist movements. Sort of what it's called the traditionalist Islamic elements were those based in rural areas in the Pasantren, rural boarding Islamic boarding schools, and this sort of divide ended up resulting in the formation of two very large Islamic organizations: the modernist represented by one called Muhammadiyya, and the traditionalist represented by one called Nahdlatul Ulama or NU. NU was the organization that the president before Megawati, Abdulrahman Wahid or Gus Dur, came from NU. But both of these organizations have been, you know, very moderate, in fact, and not very prone to any kind of violence or even any serious insistence on anything like the formation of an Islamic state or anything of the kind. There were very large political and social organizations. There's the radicalization of certain Islamic elements is very complicated and difficult to explain in any sort of succinct way. But I just want to point out, because this is not very familiar to many people, that much of the most radical Islamic groups were actually supported by elements of the Indonesian Special Forces, including Suharto's son-in-law, Prabowo Subianto, in the period before Suharto fell. And one of the reasons for this was the idea that Suharto was going to need a new kind of base of power, because he had sort of exhausted all of his old ones. So he was increasingly turning towards these sorts of groups.
So are these fundamentalist groups then indigenous then, or some of them are indigenous and some of them may be influenced by the outside movements?
Well, they're certainly influenced. Some of them have gone outside for schooling and so forth, but that was equally true in the 1920s and 1930s. The outside influence in and of itself doesn't guarantee much of anything.
So what is the role of religion in the state, in the national government? I mean, in the Constitution and things like that, for example, or in the judiciary?
Well, the 1945 Constitution is still in effect, which upholds the Indonesian nationalist ideology of Pancasila, the five principles, which was something that Sukarno came up with, in fact, in order to avoid the question of whether or not to make Indonesian an Islamic state. But the first principle of Pancasila refers to the belief in one God. So all Indonesians are supposed to believe in one God, but it's a non-sectarian God, in fact.
Okay, well, maybe you can get back to mobile. Thanks a lot.
All right, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Well, perhaps I should introduce again our guest, Lauren Ryder. He's professor of government at Cornell, and we're talking about Indonesia. And questions are certainly welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I suppose now, having had both callers talk about the involvement of Western business and this oil company in particular, if you'd like to talk some more about that, I want to give you the opportunity to do it.
Well, sure. I mean, Mobil Oil was the one that was involved in the discovery of the liquid natural gas in Aceh in the 1970s. Mobil Oil merged with Exxon, becoming Exxon Mobil in 1999. And they basically work in partnership with the state oil company, Pertamina, in developing and exporting this liquid natural gas, which, according to the information I have, which I'm not entirely, I can't entirely vouch for the accuracy of this, but the LNG, liquid natural gas, produced in Aceh alone accounts for 40% of the world's liquid natural gas. And so this private corporation, in partnership with the Indonesian National Oil Company, operates these facilities. And the Jakarta government receives some $1 billion a year from these operations. The private company, ExxonMobil, directly employs Indonesian military personnel as security. And that's been an element of controversy because of well, for obvious reasons that some of these security forces are involved in human rights abuses, and people are critical of the fact that they're basically treated as a personal army of a private corporation. And in fact, there's been a lawsuit filed against ExxonMobil by the International Labor Rights Fund in the United States that is related to this issue, and that, as far as I know, the status of that case is still pending.
Something that I would be interested in having you talk more about is Timor, and particularly what has been going on there in the last couple of years. And I know this is something that you have been interested in for a long time, going back, I think now more than 10 years, you were involved with other people in this country in trying to draw people's attention to what the Indonesian government was doing in Timor. This is a place that had been a Portuguese colony, and when the Portuguese withdrew in the mid-70s, Indonesia took it over. The people of Timor continued to say they wanted to be independent. Finally, there was a referendum. There was a lot of violence associated with that, committed by the government, the military of Indonesia, and people, death squads, militias that were allied with the military. It was a place for a long, long time that there was very strong evidence of violation of human rights by the government of Indonesia. Finally, there was the referendum. It did become independent. So how is Timor doing? How has it been doing since that time?
Well, it's become a fairly successful independent government, led by the main resistance leaders, Xanana Gusmão and José Ramos Horta. They've managed to get along relatively peacefully with Indonesia as its neighbor. I think that the news is fairly good for East Timor overall after those horrible years of tragedy. I'm inclined to turn this towards how East Timor influenced Aceh, because East Timor gained a whole lot of international attention, in part from the efforts of the group that I helped found, East Timor Action Network, during the 1990s, and the story was relatively successful. It embarrassed Indonesia so much that it eventually had to allow for a vote of self-determination, which despite the army's confidence that it wouldn't go towards self-determination, over 90%, I think like 98% of the East Timorese voted for what amounted to independence. This occurred in a context where there was very little attention, if any, given to Aceh and West Papua. And this was in part for strategic reasons. I think activists didn't want to confuse the issue, wanted to focus on a very clear case of a sovereignty movement that had the advantage of international law on its side. East Timor was never, the annexation of East Timor by Indonesia was never given de jure recognition by the United Nations, although it was given de facto recognition by major countries, including the United States and Australia. So it had this status of international law on its side. Aceh and Papua did not have the same kind of clarity of international law status. So there was not much attention given to Aceh and Papua among activists, and consequently the media focused almost no attention on Aceh and Papua. But after 1998, both Aceh and Papua saw opportunities. And in fact, in 1999, at around the time that the vote of self-determination was occurring in East Timor, there was a huge demonstration in Aceh of over a million people, some say 2 million, which would account to anywhere between 25 and 50% of the entire population of Aceh coming out to peacefully demonstrate, demanding a referendum on self-determination in Aceh. Those sentiments were sort of given encouragement by the then president, Gustur, who said that maybe something like that might be necessary. Fortunately, the military had different opinions of the matter and did not allow that to occur, and in part because of this policy or this position that the president was taking on Aceh, the military helped get rid of this guy, Gustur, and put in somebody who was much more sympathetic towards the idea of national unity and integrity, Megawati Sukarnoputri, ironically the daughter of the first president, Sukarno. And since then, the news has been very bad for Aceh in particular. There's one other tie to East Timor that I think is important to mention. As many people know, in East Timor, part of the military strategy of making sure that the independence vote went towards Indonesia, in other words, against independence, was to promote the formation of these civilian militias, which ended up being extremely violent and brutal. I think that in Aceh, the military realized that the situation had backfired. And although it's clear that since the late 1980s and in the 1990s, the military supported similar sort of pro-Jakarta civilian militias in Aceh, one thing they did, which they didn't do in East Timor, was in fact to more seriously infiltrate the Free Aceh movement. And this is a bit surprising, but the strategy was, if they could get influence among the leadership of certain factions of the Free Aceh movement, they could better control it, and they could use it to their advantage. And one of the things that they did with these, what became known in Indonesia as Gam Gaman, referring to the Indonesian acronym for the Free Aceh movement, GAM, meaning Gam Gaman, meaning sort of fake or quasi GAM. They went through these sort of fake Free Aceh movement organizations and created disturbances. These groups might actually attack villagers to demonstrate the brutality and sort of disregard for human life of the Free Aceh movement and so forth. This is not to say, of course, that the sort of the pure or authentic or real GAM movement didn't perpetrate any abuses against civilians that they saw as siding with the Indonesian military at all. But the point is, it becomes difficult to distinguish. The situation becomes very muddied. And so I think the most important conclusion that you can draw out of this, as we're watching the events in Aceh right now, is that sometimes when you see reports of attacks by the Free Aceh movement on civilians or on particular targets or whatever, you never exactly know whether or not who's pulling the strings. Mm. It may very well be that the Indonesian military itself is encouraging these sorts of attacks in order to say, look, these people are brutal. We need to maintain our vigilance against this movement and so forth.
Well, Ed, as you have explained, there are these very strong independence movements in Aceh, in Papua. There are also other places in the country where people, if they're not organized to that extent, there are longstanding complaints they have against the central government about, particularly about how natural resources in these regions are managed and who gets basically how big their cut is. Has the government, has the Indonesian government, in ways other than trying to use force or co-opting regional movements, actually tried to address people's demands for greater autonomy?
Yes, they have. And even in the previous administrations, there have been some success at allowing for greater regional autonomy. A number of deals have been struck relating regional resources. And it's certainly true that there's a much greater share of regional resources being used by the administration of the regions rather than going to Jakarta first and then being redistributed as part of a national budget to the regions than there was during the Suharto period. I mean, this is – in that respect, the reforms have actually been relatively successful. And in fact, even in Aceh, although I don't have the exact statistics at hand, there have been negotiated settlements where a much, much greater proportion of Acehnese revenues is being controlled by the local administration in Aceh. Unfortunately, who the local administration actually is another question. The last governor of Aceh, Abdullah Putih, was very well known as a Jakarta man, and last year, middle of last year, was involved in a big corruption scandal where he was personally siphoning off a lot of these resources. So that's another, you know, that's another question. They could say that there's much more local autonomy and control over local resources, but you know, who's got their fingers in those pockets?
Well, we're coming into about our last 10 minutes. We do have some callers. Let's go to Charleston for someone right here, line number one. Hello.
Yes, just a quick question. I'm recalling the events that your guest is talking about and Sukarno, and I was younger then, and I'm trying to remember exactly if it was Sukarno or a fellow that followed him, but the news was that 300,000 so-called communists were killed during that time. Is that a part of the process, or to me it was a large event that many people were killed, and were they labeled communists under Sukarno?
Well, you're referring to Suharto. This is when Suharto took power in 1965. Away from Sukarno.
Yes, okay.
1965 and 66.
Yes, okay.
And part of the reason this incredible purge was precipitated, and 300,000 is probably a low estimate. It's certainly over 500,000 and some say over a million people who were accused of being communist were killed, not just by the military but by pro-military civilian groups in different regions, different civilian groups. In Java, in fact, by the Narutul Lama, largely, I shouldn't have singled them out exclusively, but even Abdurrahman Wahid admitted to that after 1998. And North Sumatra also, and even in Aceh, there were many Acehnese that supported this anti-PKI, anti-communist purge. And since we're talking about Aceh, I mean, I should mention that one of the reasons that there was support among the civilian population for this purge against the accused leftists was because they were successfully represented by the Indonesian military as being atheists against Islam.
Yes. Well, thank you very much, sir. Very good show, Dave.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. We'll go here to another caller here. We'll go to Crystal Lake, line four. Hello.
Yeah, hi. I was wondering if manufacturing has been revived in Indonesia, because I see it that when we have when the foreign corporations like the Americans go overseas, we usually send our troops, our military aid to augment that if there's no uprising, which eventually there was in East Timor, as you said. But I was wondering, since the Asian flu, if the manufacturing revived, and I know that China is now the most favored nation, but I'm not actually sure what's going on in Indonesia. But I do think we send our troops overseas, our military aid of some form, to augment U.S. corporations doing business over there. But after the Asian flu occurred in Indonesia, when capitalists suddenly withdrew, and perhaps that was, I forgot now, whether that was because of economy going down in the United States, or whether China was becoming the lead foreign manufacturer, replacing American factories. So I think that the troops, I'm glad Congress did stop aid to Indonesian forces, and I wish they would do it all over the world, but I'm not sure just whether it was the Asian flu that, or the uprising in East Timor and Aceh demonstrations that caused the industry leaving Indonesia, at least for a while.
Yeah, well, I don't know. Professor Ryder, maybe you might want to talk a little bit more about the Indonesian economy generally, or any specific points about it that you'd like to make.
It's certainly the Indonesian economy has been in bad shape since late 1997, which was before this flu, which didn't much affect Indonesia actually. And it's never fully recovered, and it's in the process of recovering. The Indonesian rupiah has gotten much stronger. In 1998, it was, I think, as high as something like 18,000 rupiah to the dollar, and now it's more like 8 or 9, which is much better for Indonesia. And investor confidence is returning, in part because of the perception, at least, that this new government is going to bring greater stability and security of investments and so forth. So it's possible that the strength of the Indonesian economy will improve. Manufacturing never really died. In fact, as you can imagine, the crisis only made Indonesian goods cheaper for exports. So the crisis was actually good for foreign investment.
Let me ask you this question, and I will apologize because I know a lot of people will say it's emblematic of the what's wrong with the way that the United States looks at the rest of the world. But I'll ask it anyway, and that is, why is it that what happens in Indonesia should matter to us here in the United States? I mean, what sort of stake do we have in Indonesia's future? And then I suppose that the next question would be, if we haven't been involved constructively in the past, how might we be involved constructively in the future?
Wow, those are big questions. I mean, Indonesia has always been of great strategic importance. It was during the Cold War. First of all, there's military strategic importance. Naval warships have to go through the Straits of Malacca to get anywhere else between, say, Africa or South Asia and East Asia. And during the Cold War, it was seen as part of the non-communist bloc and so forth. And nowadays, it's seen as an important building bloc in the war against terrorism, whatever that might mean. But people see that in the importance of Indonesia standing on the side of the U.S. At least U.S. policymakers see that as very important. So, for a number of reasons, Indonesia's is always on the minds of U.S. policymakers, good or bad. You know, sometimes the reasons are not in the best interest of the Indonesian people, or those people in Indonesia that may have other interests. Well, there was a second part of your question, David.
I guess it was both what's in it. I sort of apologize for the question. It's both in it, what's in it for us, that is, what's the American interest. And then also because people certainly have been critical of the way that America has been involved in the region in the past, and at least they've been critical of the fact that the United States has continued to support the government and the military perhaps not been as critical as it should have been about violations of human rights. So then the question is, well, if our involvement in the past hasn't been constructive, then how might it be more constructive? You know, if we'd make you the assistant undersecretary of state for Southeast Asia, how would you advise the administration to proceed?
Well, I think we'd certainly have to say that the importance of reform within the military is absolutely crucial, that we wouldn't stand for a return to the sort of old ways of the military, and we want to see Indonesian democratization as absolutely crucial to future stability. It cannot rely on the old methods, and that this is in fact possible. That Indonesia has, a wealth of political experience. Indonesians have now successfully held two post-authoritarian regime elections. The party systems are shaping up, and that we would like to see our confidence placed in democratic institutions and in greater institutional reform, basically the return of the military to the barracks and subordination to civilian authority.
Well, there we'll have to stop because we've used the time. I want to thank you very much, Professor Ryder, for spending some time with us and talking with us. We appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me on the program, David.
And also our thanks to the folks there at Cornell for helping to provide the high-quality connection on their end. Lauren Ryder, he's professor of government at Cornell University.